Greetings. My 3-minute introduction here is being redone now, July 26, 2021, as the old one started sounding muddy. I also slightly changed and improved it, so please listen to it at least once. Thank you, my brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ, and thus in the family of God, for listening to my podcast, Personal God Consciousness in Jesus and Living Eternal Truth. I am Brother Dave, your host. Please visit my large website, www.purechristians.org, or ledbyjesus.org, the same website. You will find many valuable and comprehensive religious and spiritual resources there. When you get there, scroll about 25% down the home page, and then you may read, download, and share my always free 100-page PDF of key highlights of my books on the nature, life, and teachings of our Creator Son of God and Son of Man, Jesus Christ. If any here wish to receive by email a free copy of the text of my podcast show, comment, ask questions, and or receive more free text, just email me, dave@purechristians.org. Freely we have received truth in God's Spirit. Freely we love to share His truth. We hope and pray that you do too. We thank you, our brothers and sisters, and the perfecting family of God, of all mankind here on earth. We thank you all for listening. Thank you for your spiritual support by following, liking, downloading, and sharing these podcasts. I never ask for money. This is a 45-year-to-date labor of love. The more living truth from Jesus that you share, the more living truth you are. I have selected verses and paragraphs in each topic from the Christian Bible and from the unique 2,097-page Fifth Epical Revelation of Truth, which is named the Urantia Book, U-R-A-N-T-I-A. That supernal revelation was given to all humans on Urantia, our planet Earth, given around A.D. 1935 in modern American English in Chicago, Illinois, USA, and allows our truth-seeking minds and souls much joy and enthusiasm as we read and reflect on these powerful and transforming intellectual, moral, and spiritual truths. All reflective truth-seeking and God-conscious humans on this planet will find some value from these readings and my comments. The Urantia Book is freely available online in English, which has no copyright. Only humans can hold a copyright. However, this revelation was given by superhuman spiritual beings, making it fully free in the public domain to allow worldwide sharing to help transform our still needy planet. Please share it wisely, as too much light of truth to most humans can be initially blinding. Now, this Living Eternal Truth podcast will continue in the Urantia Book, the last part 4, The Life and Teachings of Jesus, papers 120 through 196. We are continuing our topical study, True and False Liberty and Freedom on All Levels, part 25 of 25. We are starting at paper 194, Bestowal of the Spirit of Truth, Section 2, The Significance of Pentecost, Paragraph 2. The first mission of this Spirit is, of course, to foster and personalize truth, for it is the comprehension of truth that constitutes the highest form of human liberty. Next, it is the purpose of the Spirit to destroy the believer's feeling of orphanhood. Jesus, having been among men, all believers would experience a sense of loneliness had not the Spirit of Truth come to dwell in men's hearts. And this Spirit of Truth is the full Spirit presence of Jesus Christ, our Sovereign Creator, Son of God, of our local universe, and the full Spirit of God, the Universal Father in Paradise. And those two are fully one here and in the Father-Son Union Spirit of Truth, even the Spirit of all truth. Now we go to Section 3. What happened at Pentecost, paragraph 5 and 9. On the day of Pentecost, the religion of Jesus broke all national restrictions and racial fetters. It is forever true. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. On this day, the Spirit of Truth became the personal gift from the Master to every mortal. This Spirit was bestowed for the purpose of qualifying believers more effectively to preach the gospel of the kingdom. But they mistook the experience of receiving the outpoured Spirit for a part of the new gospel which they were unconsciously formulating. The manifestations associated with the bestowal of the new teacher and the reception of the apostles' preaching by the men of various races and nations gathered together at Jerusalem indicate the universality of the religion of Jesus. The gospel of the kingdom was to be identified with no particular race, culture, or language. This day of Pentecost witnessed the great effort of the Spirit to liberate the religion of Jesus from its inherited Jewish fetters. Even after this demonstration of pouring out the Spirit upon all flesh, the apostles at first endeavored to impose the requirements of Judaism upon their converts. Even Paul had trouble with his Jerusalem brethren because he refused to subject the Gentiles to these Jewish practices. No revealed religion can spread to all the world when it makes the serious mistake of becoming permeated with some national culture or associated with established racial, social, or economic practices. Paragraph 14. Before the teachings of Jesus, which culminated in Pentecost, women had little or no spiritual standing in the tenets of the older religions. After Pentecost and the brotherhood of the kingdom, women stood before God on an equality with man. Among the 120 who received this special visitation of the Spirit were many of the women disciples, and they shared these blessings equally with the men believers. No longer can man presume to monopolize the ministry of religious service. The Pharisee might go on thanking God that he was not born a woman, a leper, or a Gentile. But among the followers of Jesus, woman has been forever set free from all religious discriminations based on sex. Pentecost obliterated all religious discrimination founded on racial distinction, cultural differences, social caste, or sex prejudice. No wonder these believers in the new religion would cry out, "Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty." Paragraph 20. Prayer did not bring the Spirit on the day of Pentecost, but it did have much to do with determining the capacity of receptivity which characterized the individual believers. Prayer does not move the divine heart to liberality of bestowal, but it does so often dig out larger and deeper channels wherein the divine bestowals may flow to the hearts and souls of those who thus remember to maintain unbroken communion with their Maker through sincere prayer and true worship. Paper 195 after Pentecost, Section 1, Influence of the Greeks, Paragraph 1. The Hellenization, that's Greek, Greece, the Hellenization of Christianity started in earnest on that eventful day when the Apostle Paul stood before the Council of the Areopagus in Athens and told the Athenians about, quote, the unknown God, unquote. There, under the shadow of the Acropolis, this Roman citizen proclaimed to these Greeks his version of the new religion which had taken origin in the Jewish land of Galilee. And there was something strangely alike in Greek philosophy and many of the teachings of Jesus. They had a common goal, both aimed at the emergence of the individual, the Greek at social and political emergence, Jesus at moral and spiritual emergence. The Greek taught intellectual liberalism, leading to political freedom. Jesus taught spiritual liberalism, leading to religious liberty. These two ideas put together constituted a new and mighty charter for human freedom. They presaged man's social, political, and spiritual liberty. And that is coming on, thank God, more and more every day. Despite the negative news, if you can see the big picture, you see it's God's will that we continue to progress each and every day. That's worldwide, the total of all mankind. And some are going down, some are coming up, but overall, the total has to be continual progress. Section 3, under the Roman Empire, paragraph 3, Christianity came into favor in Rome at a time when there was great contention between the vigorous teachings of the Stoics and the salvation promises of the mystery cults. Christianity came with refreshing comfort and liberating power to a spiritually hungry people whose language had no word for unselfishness. Section 6, Materialism, paragraph 16 and 17. Freedom or initiative in any realm of existence is directly proportional to the degree of spiritual influence and cosmic mind control. That is, in human experience, the degree of the actuality of doing, quote, the Father's will, unquote. And so, when you once start out to find God, that is the conclusive proof that God has already found you. That's tremendous. Paragraph 17, a sincere pursuit of goodness, beauty, and truth leads to God. And every scientific discovery demonstrates the existence of both freedom and uniformity in the universe. The discoverer was free to make the discovery. The thing discovered is real and apparently uniform, or else it could not have become known as a thing. Section 7, the vulnerability of materialism, paragraph 23. A scientist, not science, perceives the reality of an evolving and advancing universe of energy and matter. The artist, not art, demonstrates the existence of the transient Mirantia soul world intervening between the material existence and spiritual liberty. The religionist, not religion, proves the existence of the spirit realities and divine values which are to be encountered in the progress of eternity. Section 8, secular totalitarianism, paragraph 4, and then 6, and then 8, and 12. It required a great power, a mighty influence, to free the thinking and living of the Western peoples from the withering grasp of a totalitarian ecclesiastical domination, church clergy domination. Secularism did break the bonds of church control, and now in turn it threatens to establish a new and godless type of mastery over the hearts and minds of modern man. The tyrannical and dictatorial political state is the direct offspring of scientific materialism and philosophic secularism. Secularism no longer frees man from the domination of the institutionalized church, then it sells him into slavish bondage, into the totalitarian state. Secularism frees man from ecclesiastical slavery, only to betray him into the tyranny of political and economic slavery. Paragraph 6. Secularism can never bring peace to mankind. Nothing can take the place of God in human society. But mark you well, do not be quick to surrender the beneficent gains of the secular revolt from ecclesiastical totalitarianism. Western civilization today enjoys many liberties and satisfactions as a result of the secular revolt. The great mistake of secularism was this. In revolting against the almost total control of life by religious authority, and after attaining their liberation from such ecclesiastical tyranny, the secularist went on to institute a revolt against God himself, sometimes tacitly and sometimes openly. It is not necessary to sacrifice faith in God in order to enjoy the blessings of the modern secularistic revolt. Tolerance, social service, democratic government, and civil liberties. It was not necessary for the secularist to antagonize true religion in order to promote science and to advance education. Paragraph 12, secular social and political optimism is an illusion. Without God, neither freedom and liberty nor property and wealth will lead to peace. Section 10, the future. This is a very important section. Paragraph 5, in winning souls for the Master is not the first mile of compulsion, duty, or convention that will transform man. When they say man, they mean all humans, male and female equally, because we're all spiritually classified. All males and females are equally spiritually classified as sons of God. That's why I have words like woman, person, female. In winning souls for the Master is not the first mile of compulsion, duty, or convention that will transform man and his world, but rather the second mile of free service and liberty-loving devotion that betokens the Jasonian, we're sons of Jesus, all of us, reaching forth to grasp his brother in love and sweep him on under spiritual guidance toward the higher and divine goal of mortal existence. Christianity even now willingly goes the first mile, but mankind languishes and stumbles along in moral darkness because there are so few genuine second milers, so few professed followers of Jesus who really live and love as he taught his disciples to live and love and serve. Paper 196, that's the last paper in this Urantia book, The Faith of Jesus, Introduction, Paragraph 5, and then 11, and then 14, and that will be the end of this study. Theology may fix, formulate, define, and dogmatize faith, But in the human life of Jesus, faith was personal, living, original, spontaneous, and purely spiritual. This faith was not reverence for tradition, nor a mere intellectual belief which he held as a sacred creed, but rather a sublime experience and a profound conviction which securely held him. His faith was so real and all-encompassing that it absolutely swept away any spiritual doubts and effectively destroyed every conflicting desire. Nothing was able to tear him away from the spiritual anchorage of this fervent, sublime, and undaunted faith. Even in the face of apparent defeat, or in the throes of disappointment and threatening despair, he calmly stood in the divine presence, free from fear, and fully conscious of spiritual invincibility. Jesus enjoyed the invigorating assurance of the possession of unflinching faith, and in each of life's trying situations, he unfailingly exhibited an unquestioning loyalty to the Father's will. And this superb faith was undaunted even by the cruel and crushing threat of an ignominious death. Paragraph 11. In the earthly life of Jesus, religion was a living experience, a direct and personal movement from spiritual reverence to practical righteousness. The faith of Jesus bore the transcendent fruits of the divine spirit. His faith was not immature and credulous like that of a child, but in many ways it did resemble the unsuspecting trust of the child mind. Jesus trusted God much as a child trusts a parent. He had a profound confidence in the universe, just such a trust as a child has in his parental environment. Jesus' wholehearted faith in the fundamental goodness of the universe very much resembled a child's trust in the security of its earthly surroundings. He depended on the Heavenly Father as a child leans upon his earthly parent, and his fervent faith never for one moment doubted the certainty of the Heavenly Father's overcare. He was not disturbed seriously by fears, doubts, and skepticism. Unbelief did not inhibit the free and original expression of his life. He combined the stalwart and intelligent courage of a full-grown man with the sincere and trusting optimism of a believing child. His faith grew to such heights of trust that it was devoid of fear. And in this Urantia book, it states, "Unreasoned fear is a master intellectual fraud practiced upon the evolving mortal soul." That's one of my favorite statements. And here's the last of paragraph 14. Jesus' earthly life was devoted to one great purpose, doing the Father's will, living the human life religiously and by faith. The faith of Jesus was trusting, like that of a child, but it was wholly free from presumption. He made robust and manly decisions, courageously faced manifold disappointments, resolutely surmounted extraordinary difficulties, and unflinchingly confronted the stern requirements of duty. It required a strong will and an unfailing confidence to believe what Jesus believed and as he believed. Thank you very much. That concludes this topical study. And then in about 2 weeks, maybe a little less, we'll start a new topical study. And rather than saying goodbye, I like to say farewell, do well. ¶¶